The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 25th, 2024. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see you all today. Beautiful sunny day. Well, there's a story of the Buddha. It starts out like another well-known story, but I'll just cut to the chase here, though. But it's about a general who came to see the Buddha. He was heading off to battle, leading his army. But he was told that the Buddha was a very wise person and that you should check him out, somebody said, you know. So he checked in to see the Buddha, but he said, I'm in a hurry, I'm off the battle or whatever. And he said, can you just give me your teaching in a word? And the Buddha said, awareness. Summed up his teaching in one word, awareness. And the general went off to battle. Probably, oh, awareness, okay. Just keep on my guard, stay sharp, something like that. Who knows what he thought, but he leaves. But we're left with that word. And probably when we encounter this particular teaching and we hear that word awareness, odds are we're thinking of things or thoughts, ideas, feelings, sensations, but awareness. And that's problematic if you do look at it this way. So I want to say a little bit about that today, because what the Buddha was talking about there, his teaching, it sums up to not conscious awareness. That's what we're probably thinking of, where we're conscious of an object. And of course, along with that object is the subject, me, conscious of that, you know, aware of that, we're thinking. But this isn't really, they're sure that this is included in what the Buddha said, but if that's the limitation of it, it's just ordinary stuff. And the Buddha's teaching doesn't sum up to just that. The Buddha is speaking of objectless awareness. If I were writing that out, I would give it a capital A, awareness. If we don't really understand this distinction, when we're hearing the teaching or reading the teaching, then we're making a mistake. There's a limitation there. And we're not really hearing what is being said. Well, this morning, many of you know you're in the class. I've been teaching a class on mind and consciousness, a no-brainer, as I call it. And I've been wanting to get to this word awareness. I've tried several times, but I haven't quite made it. And there's only one session left of the class, so I don't know how far I'll get with it then. So I want to say something about it today. Anyway, there's somebody who's in the class, lives out of state, who I've gotten several emails from people since this class has been on. Anyway, this was rather interesting. It was sent to me last night, I guess, but I didn't see it till this morning. And I thought, well, this would be a good starting point. I won't say who the person is. I haven't cleared it with this person, so I don't want to reveal names here, just to guard their privacy. But if you're listening now, the person who sent me this, and you want to disclose yourself later after my comments here, if you have a question or further comment you want to make, that would be perfectly fine. But for now, I'll just keep it anonymous. And this is only a portion of what was sent to me. But it was very, very interesting. It allows me to bring out some pretty subtle points here that I think would just, for a general audience now, not necessarily in the class, this might be helpful for you. Because there is confusion about that word, awareness, and the way the Buddha used it. If this is the summation of everything he teaches in that single word, So here the person who wrote to me then said that we can never experience anything outside our experience. And any effort to verify that anything exists outside our conscious experiencing can only occur as an experience in consciousness. Every brain that is being operated on, every scientific experiment, every mathematical formulation appears in conscious experience as conscious experience. That is experientially clear and obvious. But does it prove that there isn't anything outside of or other than consciousness? It seems to me we cannot know. So, just using this as sort of a starting point, I'm going to go over this again here more slowly. But I'll use the personal pronoun she, because it was from a woman. By the way, I should say a woman who I've been in touch with for a number of years, and she's an excellent student of the Buddha Way and other teachings as well, and religious backgrounds. And she's very knowledgeable and very experienced. And she does, you know, some teaching. She used to kind of check in with me with that. And I finally told her that I didn't give her transmission or anything, but I told her, you know, your understanding is very good and you should just go ahead and offer what you can offer. And so I just want to let you know that this is from a very senior and experienced person in the Buddha way. But still, there is a very subtle misunderstanding here. And that's why I thought it would be helpful to bring it out. And as a kind of a sidebar to what I'm able to cover now in the class, because I didn't give myself enough time, I should have made it a longer course. But anyway, we can take care of this today. But she says, we can never experience anything outside our experience. Well, already, and then in the next half of the phrase there, she says, any effort to verify anything that exists outside our conscious experiencing can only occur as experience in consciousness. But in just saying that, she didn't use the term conscious experience in the very first place here. But that is just by using the word we and our. You know, we can never experience anything outside our experience. And without using the word consciousness, but here the word consciousness is implied just by using those terms we and our. Objectless awareness isn't our experience. It doesn't belong to us. You know, we don't have this as like our own personal thing, objectless awareness. We have our own conscious awareness, conscious experience, yes. But that doesn't apply to this term awareness. That's why I would give this term the way the Buddha used it, with a capital A. If it was my awareness of, say, the Zafu over there, I wouldn't give that a capital A. It's just a relative truth, a relative awareness of an object, and I am seeing that or whatever. But when the Buddha spoke, when he asked, can you sum up the whole of your teaching here in a word, he says awareness. This has to be objectless awareness, not awareness of things and ideas and people and going off to war and stuff like this. It's awareness of reality as a whole. And that whole, I would also capitalize. Totality. And by the way, in this class that I'm doing on mind and consciousness, a no-brainer. One of the things I wanted to say, and I have pointed it out, but I haven't really spent as much time with it in the class for lack of time for all the things I'm trying to cover in that class, on consciousness, that it's used, it's overused. I've mentioned this, I pointed it out, because there's so much more here. There's awareness, and I think the way that people commonly use that term consciousness, they're probably, but not always, thinking of just simply awareness. But again, then it's conceptual awareness. And that's where the person who wrote this now is thinking in these terms. But it also works in other ways too, where people think that, well, you know, human beings have consciousness, not too sure about dogs and cats and amoebas and things like this. But people do. And so it's like, this is a human quality. Some people will think that. But then they're thinking about self-consciousness, or when we have this consciousness of a self. Well, human beings really seem to have this. I'm not too sure about dogs and cats and trees. But so there's all kinds of ways that, and it's in the everyday discussions now going on about brain and mind and consciousness and artificial intelligence, all of this stuff, and computers and things of this sort. A lot of confusion here. But the term awareness is almost never used. I never seem to run into it anywhere. There's other terms here too I want to get to maybe before we run out of time here today that we can use that might help us in this area. But for most of us, we probably are thinking, well, I don't know, maybe it isn't most of us, but many of us, I'm sure, we're thinking in terms of conscious awareness or conscious experience. And that's what we have here, I think. We can never experience anything outside our experience. That would be our conscious experience. I just would insert that word conscious because that's really what she's referring to here. Any effort to verify that anything exists outside, now here she does use the word our conscious experiencing, can only occur as an experience in consciousness. Well, yes, anything that we experience outside our consciousness can only occur. But here we're talking about conscious experience. And that could be like our conscious experience. So if we're talking about conscious experience, yes. In any effort to verify that anything outside our conscious experiencing can only occur as an experience in consciousness. Yes, I would agree with that. But we're talking about conscious experience now. We're not talking about immediate direct experience that doesn't have an experiencer, or objectless awareness that doesn't have an experiencer. There's just this awareness. Without the object, we don't find the subject either. And we think, well, I never experienced anything like that. Yeah, you don't. I don't either. But there is such experience, and actually, I'll say we now, but it doesn't really apply, but we all know this. We all experience this. Were this not the case, nothing would be experienced. Whether I put the we there or not, by us or anyone else, or anything else, there just wouldn't be the experience. With the experience of objects, now all of this is here. Here it is. This is conscious awareness. But the Buddha was speaking of something more than just this. He was speaking of objectless awareness. But we'll get to that here in a bit. But she goes on here. She says that every brain that is being operated on, every scientific experiment, every mathematical formulation appears in conscious experience. Well, actually, that's not quite true, particularly in mathematical formulation. And I kind of touched on this a bit in the last class, using that cartoon from Sidney Harris. Here's the mathematical operation, and there's this space of, well, the mathematician writes, and then a miracle occurs, but there's no math going on there, and then all of a sudden we're back to math again. And in these experiments, in these mathematical operations, this is really the case. There is math that works this way, whereas we start out, like in quantum mechanics, you can very often you start out with an object of some kind. You can conceive of it, and working with the operation, all of a sudden, what's happening is we have to resort to what are called imaginary numbers or complex numbers or quaternions and things like this, and you don't have an object. Don't worry about this. I'm not going to get into the math or anything like this here. I do want to teach a separate lecture, give a separate lecture that gets into this and much more, but I just want to let you know that there is such a thing as this. But what it's saying here in relation to what our writer says here, that every mathematical formulation appears in conscious experience. Yes, when you're working out this math, eventually we're back to the imaginary numbers cancel out, and we're back to using real numbers. And the instant we're using real numbers, they apply to objects. And then we get our solution. And it seems like in that space where we had We have no way of conceiving of what's going on there. We can conceive of the operation, the mathematical operations, but we can't conceive of what are we even dealing with here. But it seems like there must be something there, because we end up with the correct answer over here, even though we had to go through that space where it didn't seem like we had any objects at all. So this gives us a big clue to the nature of consciousness and how it may, or in this case maybe, may not apply to our brains. You're moving into more than three dimensions, for one thing, or even four with time. And this would be characteristic of this, that there's something going on. We cannot conceive of things beyond three dimensions, in spite of what some very imaginative mathematicians might think, that they can imagine things in four or five, six dimensions. Yeah, we can think we do, now, because now we have constructs. If you're thinking you do, and you, yeah. But draw it out for me. Show me a picture of it. And that's been tried too. But these are just mathematical objects that aren't appearing in consciousness. And they can't, because consciousness is incapable of taking us beyond three. Well, I can bring us into four. We can kind of stand at the doorway there and look into the fourth dimension, which shows up as time. But anyway, but I'll save all that for the the math class that I want to do that connects with all of this. But so I'll let it go here. But just to say that every mathematical formulation appears in conscious experience, but all of this appears as conscious experience, is the point she's making here. And that's correct. It all appears as conscious experience. Essentially what she's saying is that conscious experience appears as conscious experience. Yes. And she's quite right about that. And then she says that is experientially clear and obvious. Yes, I agree. But does it prove that there isn't anything outside of or other than consciousness? And then she says, it seems to me we cannot know. Yeah, this would be correct. I would agree with that, that yeah, we cannot know this, but basically we cannot know this conceptually is really what she's saying. Or if she did put it that way, yes, I would agree. We cannot know this conceptually, what she's saying. It doesn't mean that it is not known. And in fact, I would say that conceptual knowledge isn't even knowledge. It's belief, it's conjecture, it's theory, it's, you know, things of this sort. But it's ideas, it's concepts. This is conceptual knowledge. And for most of us, we take that as knowing. But it is really no different than belief, really. Since the time of the ancient Greeks, when they were talking about belief, they were trying to separate belief from knowledge. And they couldn't do it. And over the millennia since, we still haven't done it, really. We've tried, come up with some very sophisticated ways of doing it. But actually, it can be done. And I outlined that in my last book, The Grand Delusion. But what it comes down to is that what we take to be knowledge, conceptual knowledge, is ultimately not really knowing. Knowing is with objectless awareness. This is true knowing, true knowledge. And it is exceedingly simple, and there's no complexity to it whatsoever. Mathematics will not work there. And the conceptualizing, this is what consciousness is, to conceptualize the actual immediate direct experience into this and that. And you know, it's very functional and useful. It gives us everything, the wonderful things as well as the horrifying things in life, are all of that nature. And that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with any of that. I'm not negating any of it or saying it's bad or whatever. It's just that ultimately, this isn't what's going on. If it were just that alone, if it were just conceptual knowledge, in other words, or you know, conceptual objects, whatever, nothing would be happening. The only way this actually comes into the vibrancy that we know as life is by realizing this objectless awareness, which is the nature of reality. It doesn't have anything to do with space or time. You know, it isn't extended in space, space and time. This is conceptual stuff. It's constructed of other conceptual constructs. In that particular case, they're purely mathematical, but nevertheless, here they are. This also answers the big mystery. Why does math seem to apply to the real world of stuff? Well, this takes care of that question, which otherwise remains a mystery for people. Mathematicians and philosophers, you know, been pondering this for centuries. Einstein, you know, was working on it. You know, why does math seem to apply to the physical world? You know? Well, because the physical world is mind. And that's a direct seeing and realizing of mind itself, mind now with a capital M, not your mind or my mind or something like that. Those are, again, mental objects, my mind, your mind, myself. You know. Whatever object we might pick there shows us the whole thing, like a hologram almost, you know, like any little piece of it there will show you the whole thing. Or like Indra's net, you know, if you know that image. Same kind of thing being pointed to there. This is how it is. But the things themselves aren't anything at all unto themselves, the things that are appearing here. Whatever you want to name, you know, whether it's a physical object of some sort or a thought, a feeling, anything at all that can be singled out and spoken of as though it were a thing, you know. It is of this nature that in and of itself, it is not, you can't really say there's anything there at all. But we can't say there's not because here this is appearing here. But the actual knowing or realizing of what is taking place is outside of this conscious knowing and conscious grasping. And this is directly experienced. And you, all of us, the words are not adequate here, but we all experience this directly. Can't really put that into words, but there's nothing even mysterious about it. It only becomes mysterious if you try to figure out what I'm pointing to here. You can't figure it out, so don't try. There's nothing to figure out. But if you pay attention, very careful attention, very quiet and undisturbed attention to the actual experience of this moment, you can see for yourself just what this is. This is what the awakened wake up to. It's just this. It's available to us all. But it's a matter of getting out of the way. This is why in the last class, I quoted Dogen there where he says to his monks, you know, I tell you, monks, the reason you don't wake up is because you don't let go of your views. You don't let go of all the grasped things. And you think devoutly that what I think about this or how I see this, how I understand it, is true, is real. And if I were without it, I don't know what I would do. It's like stuff like that. But this is all false, and you're treating it in the wrong way. Yes, these things are appearing here, but they're appearing here as really the whole. That is, everything is showing us the whole, totality, which is not an object, but can be known and realized directly. And that's the only kind of true knowledge there is, and I would give that knowledge with a capital K. Otherwise, it's an idea. You can hold it and think it's true, and that's a belief. But that's now where all the pain and suffering and confusion of your life. Some people, too, ask, well, what's the point of all of this? Well, if you've had enough with dukkha and not understanding where this is coming from and what it is, well, it has everything to do with that. And this is really what the Buddha's message is to point to this. But it's with awareness. To get it all into one word, you know, he says awareness. But that would be awareness with a capital A. It's not awareness of things or theories or thoughts or ideas. I don't have an idea here to defend about that. I'm not, in the end, of course I'm using ideas and words and things like this to sit here and give a talk, but in the end I don't want you to take hold of anything here as though, oh, then this is the truth, or oh, Steve means this, or something like that. No, I'm just inviting you to examine direct experience as it's being lived out. And, you know, for this, it's helpful, too, if we sit down and quiet down. Here's our meditation. Just settle the mind a bit and notice when things come up in the mind. But that's all we really need to do. It isn't about figuring something out. You know, when I finally understood this teaching, it isn't like I figured it out finally. Oh, you know, suddenly I could just see what Nagarjuna and the Buddha and Huangpo and others, or Dogen, were pointing at. And it's just a matter of that. And then with the seeing of it, it's like, I've known this all along. This is the same for all of us. It's a matter of some, but you're not going to think your way there. This is why Dogen says, think not thinking. You know, don't be grasping your thoughts. He tells the monks, the reason you don't wake up is because you do grasp your thoughts. So and kind of get a sense of what are these teachers pointing out? And then notice it. What am I doing with this as I'm practicing? Kind of take it to heart. And notice, and don't get mad at yourself when you are grasping, you start to realize what you're doing. This is normal for human beings to do that, to grasp at things. But just finally realize what that is, what the nature of that is. So you don't have to be fooled by it, taken in by it. That's really what this teaching is pointing at. It's not trying to hand us something. Yet again, one like the Buddha is going to give us another concept. No. If that's all Buddhism amounted to, you might as well just go out and whatever you want to do, play golf or go to the bar, I don't know, buy some clothes or go on a trip, I don't know. But try to be happy that way. Okay. And then she says, this is experientially clear and obvious, yeah. But does it prove that there isn't anything outside of or other than consciousness? No, but this isn't really knowledge as such, or objectless awareness. When I'm home and I'm working on the classes and my talks, I run through them in my mind and I can go through them fairly quickly. But when I'm actually sitting there and actually talking, it seems like things are a bit slower. And when I look on your faces and sometimes, okay, this doesn't seem to be getting across, so I'll slow down and add in some other things. And so no wonder I don't get through all the things I was planning to do. And I should have just made it a longer course. But anyway, one of the things I've been wanting to bring out is, outside of just using consciousness, because most of this stuff that people are working on today now and talking about, and can we build consciousness, you know, all this kind of stuff, the word I see over and over again is consciousness. And various people using it in all kinds of ways. So it doesn't even among the people who are doing this kind of research and thinking about it and philosophizing over it and all of this, I have different definitions. There's like no agreement here as to what consciousness the word even refers to, or conscious awareness, stuff like that. But like I said, I'm not consciously aware of any time where I've seen that word awareness in this kind of research and talk, which I've read quite a bit of over the last four decades. But there are other words that we find in Buddhism, in Buddhist teachings. I'll just list some here. Wholeness, I already used that today. I'm speaking of wholeness with a capital W, or totality with a capital T. Just words like perception and conception. We use those words pretty much interchangeably. It's like saying, you know, I perceive the clock over there. Yeah, that seems perfectly fine, you know, but strictly speaking, we don't perceive objects. This is objectless awareness. This is pure perception, is objectless awareness. And that is always operating. It's always going on. Were it not, nothing would be happening. But it's not supplying us with objects. That part shows up as the function that we call consciousness. In Buddhist teachings, anyway. It is like drawing the distinctions of what is otherwise a seamless whole. I wanted to use the case of the Blue Cliff Record last week, but just didn't have time to even look at it. It's about the seamless monument. The national teacher was, the emperor had called him in to, the national teacher was approaching death, that's what it was. And the emperor wanted to know what he could do for the national teacher. The national teacher said, build a seamless monument for me. And the emperor said, what would it look like? And then the national teacher was silent. After a long pause, and the national teacher said, do you understand? And the emperor said, no. Anyway, there's more to it than... But yeah, this seamlessness, it gets broken up. This is pure awareness, or objectless awareness. It's seamless, it's whole, it's total. There's nothing outside, there's ideas of inside and outside and in between. As Sensong says, his wake-up words, where no inside, no outside, no in-between. Yeah, with this awakening, this is seen, this seamlessness. And this is an indication of actually seeing what is taking place here. But the moment we have conscious awareness, with that consciousness, everything's broken up. Now there's objects, not just physical objects, but mental objects of various kinds, thoughts and feelings. And this is directly seen, available to us to realize this, to know that the actual experience is being carried on in this way, instead of the idea that there are actual physical things out there, you know, and I'm here, serpent apart, it's all divided up in this way. And that seems quite real, you know, palpable. And yet with physicists, they go in, they look at like touch, you know, that isn't really like my fingers touching this table. It seems that way, you know, but actually there's electromagnetic forces that are kind of delineating a boundary there in space. Well, now space also comes into the picture and this sort of thing. This is what's there, but that's what consciousness is it's just this dividing up of what otherwise is this seamless whole, this seamless monument. The emperor wants to know, okay, because what we want to do is conceptualize right away. Well, yeah, I want to build this monument for you, but what would it look like? There's nothing to say there, really, even though something does come out in that koan, but... Anyway, why am I looking at this? Oh, yeah, and there's other terms here too, the relative and absolute. Well, because there are two truths, there's also the ultimate, which I would just want to sense. There's like three truths. There's a relative truth. That's what we live that out pretty consciously. What relative awareness is of various kinds, and, you know, things and thoughts and people and whatever, and. Time and space and dimension, all of this. But that's all relative. Then there's absolute, which is what? Well, that's not not relative, not this, not that. I kind of defined that in my book, in the glossary, what relative. You can't say. It's defined by not. Not this, not that. This is absolute. So, and it's not yielding objects either. But then the ultimate truth, though, is that this relative and absolute are not two, with the seeing of that as finally the realization and the understanding of how it is that we can have this world of this and that and coming and going and birth and death, all of this, even though there's nothing coming or going as such. At least we can't pin down anything coming or going. And yet there seems to be, in very palpable ways, things coming and going, and appearing and disappearing, all of this. Not just physical things, but also thoughts, feeling, coming and going. You know. There's the whole shebang there. But the whole thing, in the totality here, this is the wholeness and totality, all synonymous there with this awareness, capital A awareness, that the Buddha spoke of. Because directly, one has this quality of awareness. But in reality, not of anything particular, because this is all a seamless monument. And yet, there appears to be distinctions, and that is consciousness, the drawing of distinctions, the separation of one thing from another. So other words like this, also the two truths, I talked about that a little bit in the class last week, but using other words and concepts, you know, things like this, give us more ways of speaking of the richness of what this experience is. And by constantly using that word consciousness and consciousness and consciousness, our machines, can we make a conscious computer? Can we, you know, consciousness, consciousness. Do dogs have consciousness? Do stars have consciousness? Do, you know, ants, you know? But it's just consciousness. It gets kind of tiresome. And it's not even very functional anymore. And besides, who are you talking to, and how do you use that word? You know, and it's different from these other people here, or you know. So it'd be very helpful for us if we could maybe bring in some other words. But of course, where some of these words came from, is from people who have actually awoken to the immediate direct experience of just what is taking place here. And for each of us, if that interests you and you want to wake up, then it's just like Dogen says, Well, let go of your views. Doesn't mean, I don't think he means that to let go, like, you know, like I think there's a microphone here, so when I get up, I can just get up and start walking. No, it's you can comply with the appearances of things, but realize that ultimately, that's not the way it is. How is it? You can't get hold of the way it is ultimately. It's objectless. And yet here it is. So it is of that nature. But it is a matter of just finally seeing that. And the way of seeing that is the dropping away of all the stuff you're carrying. Not dropping in a way that, oh, I don't need this thing. I just, oh, you know, but dropping away of that you're not being taken in by it anymore. You see through it. You realize what it is. It isn't bad. It isn't good. It isn't anything in particular in and of itself. As for behavior and goodness and badness and things like that, we'll end up fighting over stuff like that. And yet there's wholeness, which isn't an object. You can move your mind in the direction of the whole, so to speak, except it's not in any direction. It's just and with this, in Buddhism, plain and simple, I point out, if you want to see if you're checked with your mind, and how is your mind aligned with this ultimate knowing or seeing. I didn't speak of it in those terms in that book, but it is a matter of just, if your mind is leaning, now it's your personal mind, because now it has an attitude or, you know, an inclination or a disinclination or whatever against other things and people and thoughts and whatever, to recline toward or away. So just watch, but you can tell when your mind is leaning one way or another. This is an indication of a mind caught up in the conceptual. And it's not even that the conceptual is bad, but we're there and we don't know it, and we think that the things we're leaning toward and away from and this sort of thing are real and ultimate. But it's not of that nature at all. And in the seeing of that and in noticing your own inclination toward and away, this will help us to finally just wake up to what's actually going on. Sin Ching Ming, it begins with this, that the great way is not difficult. There is nothing it prefers. It often gets translated now in English as for those who have no preferences, or some version of that. Yeah, that's fine, but there's still grasping going on with that. If you look at the Chinese, I don't think it's quite worded that way. But then it's like, oh, how is it worded? Well, it's strange. It's just really, the great way has no difficulty. There's nothing it prefers. Well, what is the great way that we might think that it could have preferences anyway? I mean, preferences or not, I mean, you know, it just gets confusing for us right away. And yet all it's saying is this totality, this wholeness, this seamless monument, it doesn't lean toward anything. There's nothing outside it to lean toward. It's, you know, and this is mind with a capital M. In the way directed to Wang Po, look at how he speaks of this. And to the extent that your mind is jostled and twisted and turned and pulled and tugged and it's leaning and whatever, just watch that. And if you can start to realize that the things that you're allowing to just pull you this way and that, and that, and that, this is just kind of fabrications of your own mind. And you say, well, it's imposed on me by other things. Well, these other things are also fabrications of your own mind, you could say. But even your own mind is a fabrication of your own. But at some point, if we just settle down, you can realize that ultimately what's going on is not your mind or my mind. You know, and with this, I didn't grasp any idea about this. I finally saw what was going on. And then when I went back to the teaching and started reading, I was like, oh, this is what they're saying. They're pointing to this all over the place. But it was like that. It's like I didn't get it because I figured out what was going on in the words there that I'd been reading for years. It was just suddenly I realized it was this. And then when I went back, when I was looking at these words, oh, gee, there it is. I mean, they're saying it. They're pointing at it. So it's kind of like that. To try to use those words now to figure it out, that's not going to work ultimately. Pay attention to what's going on very carefully. Watch your mind, the leanings of your mind. You know, if you're being pulled this way, just see if you just let that go now. Just, you know, don't try to stop leaning or whatever. It's just real, but you're being pulled. Now that's it's a belief that this is real and solid, and there's no basis for that. Just see if you can kind of handle that lightly, let go, open that hand of thought, and let it go. And maybe your mind will just lean less. But somewhere there, when it's really kind of stable, we can see what's going on. All along, if you're reading, I would say, yeah, the correct teachings of the masters, there's a lot of teachings out there that are still attached and stuck and constructed in various ways that aren't helpful. But if you get on to reading the sutras or the masters, this sort of thing, you stand a better chance of where that language isn't being used. Or of course, it ends up in translations where it does get kind of turned back into ordinary language again. But just do that very gently. Don't hang on to any of it or anything I'm saying. Don't construct what I'm saying into something. Oh, Steve said this or that. Of course, that can go both ways. Some people, I know, they highly respect what I might say, or something. Other people are kind of turned off by anything I might say, or yeah. So, but all of that, watch your mind and the leaning of your mind. You don't need to go toward or away from anything here. In the everyday, you can find things useful and handy to use and that sort of thing. That's fine. And then put them away when the use is over. You don't have to think that was good or this is bad. And you know, just watch when the mind is doing that. Settle down. And at some point, what's left for us is to actually see what's actually truly going on here. Then when you go back, now you can spot what are the masters. Who are they? Because they're pointing. There's other teachings that are being subtle ways inviting you to grasp again. That's ordinary stuff, ordinary teaching. The genuine stuff isn't, you know. But of course, when we are in a grasping mode because we don't know any better, no, I don't get what they're saying here. This is why Nagarjuna might seem so hard, you know, or Wangpo or Dogen. It's amazing what Bo did in his class now. Because that was difficult stuff, what he was bringing us through, and he did a marvelous job with it. I'm pretty impressed with that, actually. So the understanding is there. It's available to us, but to the extent that we're not trying to construct it now into some kind of intellectual, conceptual structure of some sort, we're better off. These things can be handy and useful in various ways a little bit, but again, leave them when their use is no longer necessary for the moment. Just set them down again. Be careful that they haven't allowed you to now to pick up something else that you're going to use as though this were the real thing or whatever. So it's just a matter of that. And now we can live directly out of, well, just this, just us. Tathagata, coming and going thus. Now, how the Buddha referred to what we would say myself, for him, you know, me. He didn't say me or myself. He said Tathagata. Coming and going thus, well, in the way that things actually are coming and going. They appear like coming, appear like. And Norm likes to say, as our teacher used to say, Katagiri Roshi, he'd say, looks like coming, looks like going. But there actually isn't, you can't get a hold of anything that's actually coming or going, including you. You say, well, I was born, such, I came, you know, I was born, and now I'm kind of persisting for a while, and then I'll go, and that leaves us feeling terrified. That's not exactly what's going on. Looks that way, looks like coming, looks like going. Yeah. But if we really open up to this seamless reality, where ultimately we can't draw the distinctions. Though the distinctions are there to be made, and we do make them, but then we get taken in by those. It's possible to just enjoy those, be careful with them. Some are hurtful, you know, some are wonderful, and warm and friendly and helpful. So just be careful of all of these. But watch your own mind and the leanings of your mind. As Dogen said, don't hang on to your views. Okay, well, I've certainly used up most of the hour here. I better stop. But any comments or questions about anything today here? Question. Frank, okay. Hi, Frank.
Does our mind ever fully stop leaning?
No, our mind, your mind, my mind, no. Just the very fact that there's our or me, my mind, no, that's already leaning, yeah. So to that extent, but then does that mean, so there's never, no, that's not, also not true. Of course, there's a non-leaning mind, and we've all tasted that. You, even now, without knowing it or realizing, you've tasted a non-leaning mind. It might just go flitting by from the way that we sense our experience strung out in time. But yeah, so we can't really say that, is there ever a time? Can't really say that there is. Can't say that there's not either. And see, that would be grasping again, too. And now I would just invite you to do that. And I don't mean to now never ask questions, but can you see how there's even some grasping in the question as you raised it here now? Again, I don't mean don't ask, because I think it's helpful. If you have a question, it's worth bringing it up. But on the other hand, look at the mind that's asking the question, no matter what the question might be. It's wanting to receive something that I can grip. The very thing that Dogen says, yeah, well, just, okay, he might even say, yeah, grip it momentarily, but then set it down, let it go. Don't hang on to it. So I don't know, can you follow that? It's very fluid, very changing, and there's the vibrancy of our life that's changing and constantly. It's aliveness. But it's in that way, but we're all with our conceptualizing too. We want to freeze it out into this and that, and then we imagine that whatever I've framed up here is moving along in time with me, and even my own body, as if it's still the body I had then, whenever then was, whether it's a few minutes ago or years ago, and we imagine this.
We are not a
cork,
right?
We are not a
cork.
Well, I wouldn't even say we are the stream. There's only streaming. The stream isn't even the stream. There's just the appearance of streaming, and it's an appearance. Don't even take the stream as being, This is the seamless monument now. So then there's no movement, there's no change. No, this is what the seamless monument is offering. But we take then the streaming and the seams, the drawn lines and separations, we take those to be real then. There's our mistake. Those are the views that Dogen is inviting us to. Okay, that's fine. It might be helpful in some little way here and there, but let it go. In the end, when the use is over, just let it go.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. Anything else? Okay, I guess we better end it here, but thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.